Hey, Corinne.
Broadcasting.
Good afternoon. I'm opening this meeting of the House Committee on Revenue. It's Monday, April 19th. We have four work sessions on our agenda. Apologies to those who were waiting for us to begin our meeting. We were waiting for the last couple of members to join us. Didn't want to start without the full complement today because these are some good conversations that we're about to have. Let's have a roll call, please.
Representative Levy.
Let's come back to Rep. Levy after we call the other names.
Representative Marsh.
Marsh is here by video.
Representative Smith.
Representative Smith is here by video.
Representative Valderrama.
Valderrama present by video.
Vice Chair Pham.
Vice Chair Pham is present by video.
Vice Chair Reschke.
Vice Chair Reschke is present by video.
Madam Chair Nathanson.
Nathanson present by video.
And Madam Chair, I believe Representative Levy had an appointment today, so she will not be joining us.
Okay, we'll mark her as excused. Thank you.
You bet.
Before I open the first work session, we have a work session on four bills that are all related to housing. And some relate to income tax, other proposals that we've heard either today or on other days would be about property tax. The purpose of today's meeting of these work sessions is not to move bills, so I wanted to make sure it was really clear to the committee members as well as to anyone who's watching us today that these work sessions are designed to provide an opportunity for the committee members to debrief on what we heard during public hearings, ask any additional questions of Legislative Revenue Office, or we have available a few other people for work sessions today and for other work sessions, a few people from an agency or an organization that understands the technicalities and the workings of the bill. So if you have a detailed question that LRO can't answer, we do have someone else waiting in the wings, someone else in the room with us who can answer questions. So again, today is for committee discussion, debriefing and figuring out any other aspects to this bill that they might be curious to pursue. And also, before we start these, this set of work sessions and others that will follow, some of you are pretty familiar with the memo that I sent to committee chairs some weeks ago. It was sent, dated February 4th. The memo was to House Policy Committee chairs. It was also shared on the Senate side. LPRO, Legislative Policy Research Office, also received this memo. It was some advice to committees, and it's a good reminder for us what we consider when we think about tax expenditures. And that would be things like tax credits, property tax exemptions, deductions, or any other kind of expenditure where instead of a direct appropriation that goes through the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, it is spending money in this way through the revenue system or the tax system. So in this memo, and if you'd like another copy of it, I'd be happy to forward it from my office. It has asked all the committees to review what is the public policy purpose of this tax expenditure, for example, to reduce hunger or to reduce homelessness, to increase post-secondary enrollment and therefore create a more highly skilled workforce. So what is the overarching purpose of the tax expenditure? Is there a an expected timeline to achieve the goal? Who directly benefits from this tax expenditure? Does it target a specific group? Should the sideboards be more carefully described, for example? Is a tax expenditure the effective and efficient way, or is there some other mechanism that might be considered, such as a grant or an appropriation through a program delivered by the state or local government or through local organizations? Anyway, there are a myriad of questions that are posed for committees to consider as they review tax expenditures, so we can have those on our mind as we're hearing about these. I'm going to open the hearings one at a time, and we're going to hear from an LRO economist to refresh our memory on what we heard in the public hearing, and then we'll just have committee conversation about each one of these. I'm opening a work session now on House Bill 2096A. LRO, it's over to you.
Okay, good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Kyle East, the Legislative Revenue Office. And yeah, House Bill 2096A, so this is a bill relating to an existing tax credit that Oregon has, the Agriculture Workforce Housing Tax Credit. So this tax credit was most recently reviewed, I believe it was in the 2019 session, as one of the standard review credits, and the sunset was extended at that time through January 1st, 2026. So it is right now would be scheduled to sunset in 2026 and would have its next standard review, if you will, in the 2025 session. But the change you have in House Bill 2096 has to do with the tax credit cap. There's a certification cap in place right now that exists. That as of right now would be equal to about $3.625 million in tax credits per year. And the change in House Bill 2096 would increase that to $24 million, but based on a biennial approach. So it's increasing that cap, and some of what the committee heard was the potential future demand, really, of this credit increasing. And the concern, I guess, if you will, is that that cap could be reached, which could then be a limiting factor on this agriculture workforce housing support that this credit provides in years going forward. So that's kind of the discussion that occurred with the bill in both the House Revenue Committee and then in the Policy Committee as well, is really relating to that cap. One note on the cap itself, there has been some conversation with the Housing and Community Services Department that brought this forward, and there may be an adjustment to this cap as there was a little bit of, a math error and taking into account the 50% of the credit. So there could be a change in the increase to $24 million to make that more akin to $16.75 million per biennium, would true that up with the actual request accounting for that 50%. So just putting that on your radar.
Thank you. Again, Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Easton, so I was just trying to get a handle on the numbers here. So you said about $3.625 million per year today if we just extended the credit as is. But this bill expands that to be about $12 million per year. Is that right? Or $24 million per biennium? I'm just trying to compare year to year or biennium to biennium so I get an understanding. So it's about if that's correct, then it looks like it's about a 3.5 to 4X increase in tax credits. Is that correct?
Yeah, Representative Reschke, and the sunset right now is already out through 2026. So this is just simply lifting that cap. It's not extending the time period, yeah.
And then a quick follow-up question, Madam Chair.
Sure.
Thank you. So Mr. Easton, is there, this credit's been going on for a while. Is there a specific region of the state, do you know, that uses this credit more than other regions, or is it pretty evenly spread out by population, or do we have data on that?
Yeah, Representative Reschke, we do have data. I don't have it in front of me by region right now, but definitely we do have it by, I think it's shared by county. So we could pull that up to see how that aligns with, say, population or something of that factor, yeah.
If you could do that for me at some time, that would be helpful. So thank you.
Absolutely.
Representative Pham.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. Yeah, I had two questions. First of all, can you explain what it means or what you meant by the 50% that tax credits can be used to cover 50% of the cost? I didn't quite catch that.
Yeah, Representative Pham, and there's some documentation, a few slides in OLS in the meeting materials that has some of that. But yeah, the credit itself is 50% of the eligible costs of kind of the construction or the rehabilitation of the housing. So it helps to offset half of those costs. And just when I was saying some, with the issue with the, I guess the cap or the proposal to increase the cap was, the $24 million didn't take into account that it's a 50% amount. So it was increasing a certain dollar amount was what the goal was. But the thinking was, oh no, the credit's only worth $3.625 million because it's half of the total certifications. So the cap is being, right now is being proposed to be increased more than, I think what would be considered necessary by the testimony previously received by the committee. They're trying to do a dollar amount increase without taking that 50% into account, rather than going to 24 million, I think it'd be more at the 16.75 million per biennium would be the amount of the dollar amount going forward, would still meet the expectations of Housing and Community Services Department. But again, that's an ongoing conversation. I just wanted to flag that for you all because it does look like an even bigger increase than what it will be.
Okay, and maybe in future slides that I'll explain. Could you, would this tax credit mostly be used by nonprofit housing developers, or are private developers also taking advantage of this to build agricultural worker housing?
Yeah, Representative Pham, it could be both. And some of what the committee heard as well is this can also be on-site housing or off-site as well. So on-site of the farm, and then the shift has been more recently more of the off-site housing. But it is specific to agriculture workforce housing, individuals in the agriculture workforce housing or their families. It could also include people that are retired or disabled that were agricultural workers could also qualify. But it does have those sideboards to ensure it is focusing on this workforce.
Thank you.
Mr. Easton, I'd like to take a step back from this specific bill. For people who are listening to our conversation now, it might seem a little baffling. Sometimes we don't know how much a tax credit is going to be used, and it's really a lot of guesswork about how many people might take advantage of a particular tax credit, because you can just claim it. In other cases, there is a cap. Well, what does it mean to have a cap? In some cases, maybe it means it's a first come, first serve, and somehow the person who would like to claim a tax credit is applying to an agency, for example. They have to be what might be called certified, let's say, to receive the credit. But it's first come, first serve. In other cases, an agency may review a bunch of different applications and approve some and not others. Can you just give us an overview of why some tax credits have a cap and some don't, and what it means for this one to have a cap?
Yes, Madam Chair. So yeah, in many of the tax credits that we have, we can have different types of caps. To your point there is sometimes a cap can be based upon an individual, say no individual can receive more than X amount of dollars. Or you could have a program-wide cap, which it would be something similar to this case where there's a certain dollar amount for the year or the biennium or no more than X amount of credits can be outstanding at any time. So there's a few different approaches on how to place that cap, and then how to address that as well, I think, depends upon the credit and perhaps the structure, what its policy goal is on whether or not you do something as a first come, first serve, or do a proportional reduction if it's over subscribed or something to that effect. And I know with these housing ones, and I think the Housing and Community Services Department can probably speak more to this, but just housing, whether it's agricultural workforce or just low income housing support in general, a lot of these projects are receiving multiple multiple ways of support, whether it's a federal tax credit, a local tax credit, a grant, or something to that effect, where these can really be projects that are receiving multiple, I could use the term subsidy for lack of a better term, but multiple ways of supporting these projects and going forward. And so there's always a balance there. But I would let the housing department can probably speak more to how they weigh those different things, the grant money, all that, and how to balance those when viewing these projects going forward on who qualifies, who doesn't. And again, for this credit, it is per year. So if there's a project that doesn't qualify this year, then it could be something that could go forward the following year as well.
Thank you. Committee members, do you have any other questions for LRO, or would you like to call in someone from the agency to explain anything else about this bill? Rep. Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Easton, just again to follow up on the conversation about $16.75 million, is that a per year number or per biennium number?
Yeah, Representative Reschke, that would be the per biennium.
Per biennium, 16.75.
Okay. And I think that aligns in the testimony from the housing department was the increase they were seeking was a $9.5 million increase. So it would still give them that $9.5 million increase, but pointing to the credit amount, yes.
Thank you.
Anything else on this bill? We have three others to continue with once we're done with this bill. Rep. Reschke, did you have anything else on this one? Okay.
I do not.
Okay, Mr. Alanak, anything else you want to mention on this bill before I close this work session?
No, Madam Chair.
Okay. I'm closing the work session on House Bill 2096. I'm opening a work session on House Bill 2446.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, this is Jamie McGovern for the Legislative Revenue Office. House Bill 2446 would include low-income housing as part of nonprofit property tax exemptions. This is already in statute and would extend the sunset. And so I have a short presentation. And I'll also be able to talk a little bit about what happened in the policy committee. This came from housing, if you would like.
How short? I haven't looked in advance.
Chair Nathanson, I think I have six slides, including our title slide and the ending contact slide.
Okay, let's try to move through them quickly.
Okay. Let me know when you've seen my shared screen. Here.
There we go.
Okay, so Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, House Bill 2446, as I mentioned, it deals with a property tax exemption. So, just a little bit of background about the bill and history. This bill would extend the sunset of nonprofit low-income housing tax-exempt status out by 6 years. And this came to the House Committee on Housing January 28th as a public hearing and was referred and sent to House Revenue on March 4th. We've had a public hearing on this on March 25th. And then just to talk a little bit about some of the issues that came up, the questions about who qualifies for low-income housing, what that means, why low-income housing is some sort of separate part of nonprofit tax exemption status, and sort of the funding and tax impacts, revenue impacts in local communities. Okay, so what happened here in order for this to become on the Oregon law's books was that in 2013, the Corvallis Neighborhood Housing Services got some property from Linn County Affordable Housing, excuse my voice. And essentially what the question came before the county tax assessors was this property going to be taxed now that it wasn't going to be operated by Linn County? And then the legislature moved forward dealing with this by specifically exempting low-income housing as part of nonprofit property, saying that low-income residency was an acceptable use for exclusive use of nonprofit property. And then the sunset has been extended out, and that's what's being considered again here. And so then now we just have this as part of our Oregon statutes, and now we have occupation as an acceptable use of nonprofit property for low-income housing. And we talked a little bit about this last time. I know that there were questions on the revenue impact. That's something that we're still working on, because the revenue impact that you would see in the tax expenditure report from the Department of Revenue that would include this is part of all of the charitable, literary, and scientific organizations, all that other nonprofit property that we're talking about. So it's part of these numbers that you see here before you of approximately $240 million. And then a shift statewide. And so what I've been working with the counties is identifying the specific amount of our property that would be included here. And so, for instance, in Lane County, the amount of property that would be included for just the housing portion is approximately $700,000. With a revenue impact of for that property of around $10,000. So you can see that it's definitely not the large part of the property of all nonprofit property. It's just a slice of that. And when we don't have information back from all of the counties yet, which is, you know, how we're working towards a revenue impact statement, but that's the type of work that we're doing to get those the type of perspective on what portion is that property that's being used as low-income property. And that is all I have.
Thank you. Committee, questions about House Bill 2446? Questions or conversation? I'm going to ask one. Ms. McGovern, if there is a tax lot that is used partially for low-income housing, but partially for something else, how does that work? Is there a pro rata exemption?
Chair Nathanson, my understanding is that it is pro rata. There's some language in the Oregon laws which essentially would terminate the property tax exemption when the property becomes completely not for use of low-income housing. So if it severs all of those connections, then it wouldn't be eligible for this property tax exemption. There are definitions around low-income housing and averaging that are in effect now that would allow different sort of income groups to remain in the property while maintaining the 60% and 80% of median income as averages. So my understanding is there's an ability to use the property in different ways and get a partial property tax exemption.
Thank you. I'd like to be sure that we have some specific either statutory language or rule that explains it just exactly that exactly how it is proportionately assessed or exempt. For example, You did mention if it's if there is no longer any connection to low-income housing, it would be severed. But I would think that other entities who benefited from this revenue wouldn't be very happy if, let's say, 10% of the property was used for low-income housing, 90% for something else, but then they found out none of it or half of it was exempt. They'd probably be a little unhappy. Representative Pham.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. I just wanted to clarify that that any property that's used in the benevolent or charitable work carried out by the nonprofit corporation would be exempt from property taxation, even if it's not low-income housing, but if it relates to the actual charitable work. If that property is being used for charitable work, then that is also exempt.
Vice Chair Pham, Chair Nathanson. Yeah, so historically, before this was passed in 2014, then nonprofit property that's exclusively used for nonprofit purposes is, for property tax purposes, considered exempt. And so that would have already been the case. And essentially, you know, these are the kind of things that we are familiar with, like animal shelters, clothing donation places where people can receive assistance. And the question that came up in 2013 and 14 was, did this fall into that exclusive use category? So those properties that would be used for nonprofits for exclusive use purposes would have already been exempted from property taxes. And then this just sort of adds to that use or clarifies that that is an acceptable use on top of what the things that we're already familiar with.
Makes sense. Thank you.
Committee, if there aren't any other burning questions on this one, I don't see any other hands up right now. I'd like to move on to the next two to make sure that we at least get the questions out. Great. I'm closing the work session on House Bill 2446. Opening a work session on House Bill 3364.
So once again, good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Kyle Easton, Legislative Revenue Office. And yeah, House Bill 3364, this is a bill that's proposing to create a new personal income tax credit. And it's, again, it's in the housing theme, but it's more related to the preservation of housing. So just to remind the committee, the last hearing on this was on 412, this is proposing a credit, and the amount of the credit, again, right now is still a blank. So it's yet to be filled in the language in the bill. But it's a credit that would be a percent of the gain realized of a taxpayer that makes a qualifying sale. So this is property that's being used for low-income housing. The qualified sale would essentially sell the property to an individual or an organization that would then keep rent restrictions on the property going forward for another, I believe it's either 20 years or perhaps 30 years. I'm checking my notes here. But to keep the property more or less continue to be used as that low-income housing property. So it's existing stock right now, and keeping that property's use going forward, and doing that by encouraging someone to make a sale of this property to another individual, keep it as low-income housing, and it does that by proposing a credit equal to a what would become a percentage of the capital gain received by that taxpayer when they sell the property. So it would offset some of that gain that occurred by the taxpayer when they sell that property.
Committee members, your turn. I'll wait just another minute.
It looks like Chair Nathanson, Rep. Marsh has her hand up.
Oh, right. It's thank you. It's very hard for me to see because it's coming in from the outside. Sorry. Rep. Marsh.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. And again, I apologize for being on a different device. I am a member of the Housing Committee as well as the Revenue Committee, and I just bring to you from a policy perspective how important this was viewed by members of the Housing Committee. We know that we need to keep low-income housing in our communities. We are in a big deficit for housing in general, and certainly for housing that is capable of taking care of our lower-income families. So from a policy perspective, this is a strong support for the change that we're looking at here.
Rep. Pham?
Yes, thank you, Chair Nathanson. As the chief sponsor for this bill, I also just wanted to echo that we have seen similar tax exemptions be really effective in helping to encourage owners of manufactured home parks to sell to an owner who promises to keep the manufactured home park affordable. And in this time, we just really need to preserve as much affordable housing stock as we can in the state. So just wanted to add my voice in support for this bill.
Thank you. Rep. Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Easton, I guess my question is, I have in my notes that this is required to go for 30 years. So when you purchase it, you're supposed to keep this stock or the housing at the low income status for 30 years. Is that correct, or is it up to 30 years?
Yeah, Representative Reschke, you are correct. By it says at least 30 years in the language of the bill.
At least, so it's up. Oh, okay, so it's at least 30 years. So this is okay. That clarifies it. Thank you very much.
Anything more on this bill? Okay. I am closing the work session on House Bill 3364, opening a work session on House Bill 2584A.
Okay, Madam Chair, House Bill 2584. So this is a bill relating to an existing tax credit. Once again, this one, the Affordable Housing Lenders Credit. So similar to what you heard about the agricultural workforce housing earlier in the committee, this is an existing credit that was previously reviewed. It has an existing sunset right now in 2026, so it'd be up for its standard review process in 2025. But the changes to the Affordable Housing Lenders Credit in 2584 are relating to, again, a cap on the credit, and in this case, an annual cap of the amount of outstanding loans that can exist. And it's increasing that cap from $25 million to $35 million. So just briefly, as kind of a refresher on what this credit is, again, it's the Affordable Housing Lenders Credit. So it focuses on the lenders in this case that are making qualified loans to financial institutions, and it gives them a credit if they reduce that interest rate on the loan for this affordable housing. So the benefit first goes through these financial institutions, but they then pass that on through reduced costs on the interest, and then that amount gets passed on onto the renters as well. There's some requirements to pass the savings directly to the renters of these properties, so it kind of filters its way through. But again, the change in the bill, the largest of the changes really is related to that overall cap of going from $25 million to $35 million. And again, this is in anticipation of potential increased use of this underlying housing, or the creation of this housing, if you will, and the potential to hit that cap in the coming years. So again, it's increasing that overall limit that exists in place right now. And there's some other, I would say, relatively smaller changes about truing up some of the language with federal statute. And then a change in the Dash A3 amendment is about the relation of purchase of bonds. Right now, Housing Community Services can issue these bonds, and it would include housing authorities as well to do these bonds. So again, a little bit more of the tweaking, and then the big change being that overall cap change.
Mr. Easton, can you describe for us, since this is an indirect relationship, this tax credit is meant to influence the cost of something. If you can reduce the cost, then ultimately it should work its way toward lower rent than what it would be otherwise. But what is the assurance that that actually is the outcome? Since it's indirect, you know, it has to pass through a couple of different steps.
Yeah, Madam Chair, so the Oregon Housing Community Services, they have oversight on this program. And so there are requirements to pass that reduced rent on, in some cases, depending upon the type of housing. For those that don't, it's generally considered because there's already restrictions in place for the rent that can be charged for the individuals that are the actual tenants. So there are requirements that for this money to actually pass through, so housing can oversee that. There is statute and rules on how that can be done. Of course, it can be adjusted based upon the tenants themselves to kind of spread that out, of course. But yeah, there is oversight in this case and certification requirements to kind of true up these dollars to make sure it's not just one's assuming that this is happening, but there is oversight to ensure that it is occurring.
Thank you. Rep. Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Easton, I think this is a question that Representative Smith brought up the first time we heard this bill, but when a loan is sold from one financial institution to another, does the new institution who purchased that loan get the tax credit or not? And I have a note here that has to be an Oregon financial institution, but I kind of want to flush that out again, or at least have you remind me how that process would work.
Yes, Representative Reschke, that was the note I made on it as well, is that it transfers to the financial institution, but I can dig into that a little bit deeper to find out exactly how that occurs when the underlying loan is transfers hands, as I understand it. But that's something I can follow up and get more information for you.
I guess another question I had was, does this apply to construction loans, or does it apply to building new housing, or just purchasing current housing stock?
Yeah, Representative Reschke, this one, it's for construction, development, acquisition, or rehabilitation. And that's, we see that in many cases for some of these, is it hits kind of those 4 points for much of this housing.
All right. Thank you.
Rep. Pham.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. Yes, Mr. Easton, I had a question in slide, I cannot see the number here, slide 3. It says that the loan recipient is required to pass on the savings to the tenant's rent, with the exception of manufactured dwelling parks and preservation projects. I thought you had said that preservation was a part of what. Can you explain a little bit more how this exception works and the reasons for it?
Yeah, Representative Pham, I'll do my best. And again, the housing department may have a little more insight on this, but yeah, that is specified. And this question came up in the housing committee before this bill came to the House Revenue Committee. And the way it was portrayed is really for the manufactured dwelling parks and the preservation projects, which is in line with the federal program there for the preservation project. But there's already can be rent restrictions in some cases, or just the way that manufactured dwelling parks, I think, are viewed as well as being in and of themselves, in many cases, a stock of low-income housing. But that is specified in those instances where there is not a requirement to follow the dollars through, I suppose, to the tenants. So that is a specific policy decision, I suppose, that is made.
I see. So there's a specific federally funded preservation project that's already getting subsidies, so that's why that's exempted. And then manufactured dwelling parks, because they're paying a different kind of rent on the space, then they're also exempted from the rent protections.
Yeah, Representative Pham, I think that's the way it was kind of explained in the Housing Committee as well. And again, with a lot of these housing programs, there are multiple layers to a lot of these affordable housing projects or if that's the right term, but there can be different layers, I suppose, of different levels of support. And one thing that is maybe not unique, but is in this program is for those that are required to have that pass through to the tenants, it does specify that this is above and beyond just if they're already receiving a reduced rent. It's like, well, we're going to count this on top of that reduced rent as well. So it will continue to lower that rent, even if it already is at a level that is considered, you know, affordable or meeting some other standard. So it is a little bit different in that it does go above and beyond some of those other requirements for, say, another program to support the building or the rehabilitation of this housing.
Great, thank you.
Part of Mr. Easton's comments related to, I think you used the word layering. There are multiple opportunities for grants, loans, preferential tax treatment, if you will, for some of these projects. Mr. Alanak, I'd like to ask you, it's my understanding there are probably at least a couple dozen different tax expenditures related to housing. Is that right? There are a lot. It's more than just these four bills in front of us.
Yes, Madam Chair. And I can send a link. I'm accessing a file that the Department of Revenue Research section has on their website. And it's an Excel file that relates to the tax expenditure report. And in there, they have a listing of all the tax expenditures with policy area. And in that file itself, because I pulled it up and I'm looking at it, there are 27 under the housing policy area. But one thing to keep in mind is that there can be multiple policy areas. And the list that I'm looking at actually does not include the ag housing construction tax credit that you heard at the top of the meeting. They have that listed under agriculture.
So, oh, it's instead of housing. Okay.
Right. And a lot of that's not uncommon. That often makes sense. So viewing that there are a couple dozen of these is about right across tax programs. That's the other piece.
Okay. What I would appreciate from LRO is, and maybe it requires working with Department of Revenue to do a keyword search to find all of those tax expenditures that have something to do with housing, whether they were dropped into a category for agriculture or something else or housing, but anything that relates to housing, to find them all. I'd like to have that list for us to see. And I'd also like for something from the agency, Housing and Community Services, to describe for us in any one given project, how they may take advantage of more than one type of public support, whether it's a grant or a loan or tax treatment. And in some cases, it may be necessary. Sometimes you need bridge financing and you need some permanent help, so forth. So I'd like to find out how many times we have projects that wouldn't move forward if it weren't for the second or third or fourth type of help, public assistance, if you will, for a project to move forward. Then again, we may learn that there are some types of projects, maybe not in the housing area, but others, where there's a second or third advantage and the last one wasn't needed to get it over that hump to make it affordable. Rep. Valderrama.
Yes, thank you, Chairman Wilson. I just had a question on one of the last things that you mentioned, Mr. Easton, in terms of the bill allowing housing authorities to also issue bonds. Can you talk a little bit about that component and why that's included here and kind of the general context there?
Yeah, Rep. Valderrama, from the conversations that I've had, and again, the Housing Community Services can probably go a bit deeper on this, but the way this was set up is HCSD can do this right now today, and then there was some concern that housing authorities by eliminating maybe a layer and allowing them go to do this directly rather than having to work their way through HCSD in issuing these bonds. And there, I think it was mentioned just like from a legal opinion that the existing statute isn't broad enough to allow them to do that. So it would just be allowing housing authorities to do something similar to what housing community services can already do. But again, that's the extent I could answer there. We could definitely get more information of what the outlook is and how much we're talking about in terms of, numerically speaking, how many housing authorities are interested in this, or it could be just one or two that are interested in pursuing something of this nature. But that's something we could get some more information on as well.
Great. Yes, I appreciate that. Thank you.
Any other questions or comments from the committee on 2584A? I'll scroll down looking for Rep. Marsh also. There we go. I don't see any other hands at this time. For everyone who was present, all of LRO and the agency people, you've heard questions from the committee. You either answered them or you're working on answers, or it may occur to you that you have additional information for us. Rep. Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This isn't necessarily for this particular bill, but my question is, when LRO is going to have produced their report, maybe they already have, and I just haven't seen the email on it, but I'd like to know when that's going to be. And then second of all, in that report, will it have the number of entities that take advantage of each tax credit or tax expenditure, so we know whether it's one group taking all of the money or doing the whole thing, or if it's a lot of entities? I'm just trying to figure out the popularity on some of these credits that we're looking at in expenditure. So that's my comment slash question on all four of these.
Good questions. Thank you, Rep. Reschke. Anything else? I think I haven't yet closed the work session on 2584A. So I'm closing that work session, but thank you, Rep. Reschke, for your last set of questions. Anything else from the committee as we head into a period where we'll be giving a lot of thought to these four different bills? Is that it for today? Mr. Olenek, any closing comments for us on what we've heard and what we might receive in the future in the way of helping us understand the context of this plus all the other housing tax expenditures?
I think, Madam Chair, you've touched on a lot of the good points, and I would just urge the members, as you're thinking through these and have questions, feel free to either compile them in a list or shoot us an email. And I found that this can often be a process of digesting the information, and everybody does that at different speeds. And then we can compile the information. We do have, Rep. Reschke mentioned a report. We do have our tax credit report that was released at the beginning of the biennium, but that was only for the tax credits that were already scheduled to sunset this biennium. Some of these, like the two housing ones today, the two existing credits weren't in that report, but they exist in earlier reports. So there can be a mix and match aspect of the data access that we have in a timely fashion, but we'll get you as much as we can.
Thank you very much. Any last comments from the committee before I adjourn? Okay. Thanks, everybody. See you next time. Oh, and by the way, hang on. Today's meeting started at a different time. this week is unusual because the floor sessions had been scheduled for a certain period of time, then they got changed to other times. Meanwhile, our committee was told, you can meet, no, you can't meet, no, you can meet at a different time. So you got to be on your toes watching for the meeting times this week. Sorry about that, but wanted to make sure that we got in our work for the week. Bye-bye.